This is Moscow Calling. Good evening, everybody. We're broadcasting on 11.63, 11.89, 15.16, 15.41, and 15.44 megacycles. Four of these frequencies are dropped at 7:30, and one new one is added. We continue broadcasting until 7:50 Eastern Standard Time on 11.89 and 15.23 megacycles. Our program for this evening brings you the news, a review of the day's press, followed by Analyzer commenting on President Truman's speech to American newspapermen. After a musical interlude, we transmit an article from the newspaper Izvestia on the land reform and food situation in Germany. Moscow Newsreel comes to you on the hour. Then, sidelights on Soviet life, 15 minutes later, and at 7:30, the news and a talk on current events. We sign off 10 minutes to 8 with the Soviet anthem. This is Radio Moscow, and here's the news. Today, the Council of Foreign Ministers held the final meeting of its Moscow session. At the beginning of the meeting, Vyacheslav Molotov replied to yesterday's statements by Mr. Marshall on the plan for a four-power pact on the demilitarization of Germany and in connection with the Austrian treaty draft. The ministers then exchanged views on the further procedure in preparing the Austrian treaty. It was resolved to form a committee of Soviet, American, British, and French representatives that shall examine all the treaty clauses still outstanding. The committee will work in Vienna. Next, there was discussion on the question of the Allied occupation forces in Germany. The Ministers' Council adopted the Soviet delegation's proposal that the Control Council in Germany should be instructed to fix by June 1, 1947, the number of Soviet, American, British, and French armed forces in Germany and report on its decision to the Council of Foreign Ministers. The ministers decided further that the next session of the Council should be held in London in November of this year. In conclusion, Mr. Bevin, presiding, moved a vote of thanks to the Soviet government for the capital conditions provided for the work of the Moscow session of the Council. Monsieur Bidault associated himself with this proposal on behalf of the French delegation and thanked the Soviet government and people for the hospitable Moscow reception. Mr. Marshall, speaking for the American delegation, likewise thanked the Soviet government for the hospitality and courtesy it had shown the members of the conference. Molotov spoke in reply. After thanking his colleagues for their cordial remarks, he said, "We have spent a good deal of time and effort in examining the questions which were on the agenda of this session of the Council of Ministers. Our work is not finished, but nevertheless no mean amount has been accomplished. We have done a substantial amount of preliminary work." After noting the importance of the German and Austrian problems examined, Molotov concluded with the hope that the work done in Moscow would contribute to the further success of the common cause and the achievement of agreed decisions on all matters still unsettled. With this, the Moscow session of the Foreign Ministers' Council concluded its proceedings. This is Radio Moscow. We follow with some items of home news. Collective farmers and workers on the state farms of Stalingrad region have sent a letter to Generalissimo Stalin. They write that part of Stalingrad region during the war was under German occupation, and that inflicted great losses on the collective farms, machine and tractor stations, and the state farms. The German fascist invaders plundered and destroyed enormous wealth created by the hands of the farmers. After the Germans were routed in the Great Battle of Stalingrad, they write further, reconstruction work was started. A good deal has been done to liquidate the consequences of the German invasion, to restore the sown area, to develop livestock breeding, but there is still more work ahead. The Stalingrad region farmers have promised to harvest a fine crop this year. The International Working Class Holiday, the 1st of May, is close at hand, and here in Moscow the streets and squares are already being decorated. Artists, carpenters, and electricians are hard at work doing the decorations for Moscow's Red Square. On the building across from the Lenin Mausoleum, banners and greenery are going up, with the emblems of the 16 Union Republics standing out in relief against a background of red. The Soviet Union has 108,000 rivers, large and small, with a total length of nearly 2.5 million kilometers. Navigation has begun on the southern rivers, as, for example, the Volga, where oil from Baku is heading north. Building materials are being shipped along the Dnieper to help rebuild factories in the Ukrainian towns of Dnipropetrovsk, Zaporozhye, and the industrial towns of the Donbass. Lumber from the northern areas of the country is coming to Stalingrad via the Volga. The Ministry of River Transport informs us that around 50 million tons of freight will be shipped along the country's rivers this year. Demobilization of men continues, the fifth contingent to be released from the Soviet Union's armed forces since the war's end. All of the demobbed men receive work and material help from the government. From the assistant chairman of the Council of Ministers of Soviet Moldavia, Ivan Podar, we learned that all the demobilized men living in the Moldavian Republic have received the jobs they wanted. Many thousands are working in the factories and on the farms, while over 2,000 former army men hold high economic and administrative posts. There are hundreds of war veterans studying at the recently opened Kishinev University and in other higher educational institutions of the Republic. During the past 2 years, more than 5 million rubles have been allocated to demobilized men in Moldavia. New apartments have been found for 4,000 veterans. The health resorts of the Crimea, robbed and demolished by the Nazi occupationists, are rapidly being restored and more people are coming to spend their vacations there. The Ministry of Health of the USSR reports that more than 20,000 people will come this summer to the Crimean sanatoriums run by this ministry. The assistant chairman of the State Planning Commission of the Russian Federation, Ivan Gruzdev, has told us that construction is far-flung at present in the villages of the Russian Federation. By the end of the year, over 250,000 peasant homes and nearly 70,000 various farm buildings will be put up in the rural districts of the Federation. The Moscow Grand Opera singer, Vera Davidova, who is back from a concert tour of the Scandinavian countries, is giving a series of programs to acquaint Moscow music lovers with the works of Danish and Swedish composers. Alexei Fyodorov, who was in command of one of the biggest partisan units in the Ukraine and was twice awarded the Hero of the Soviet Union title, has written a book on his activities in the enemy rear. The first part appears in the latest issue of the literary monthly Novy Mir, just off the press. A Czechoslovak trade union delegation arrived in Moscow today from Prague on invitation of the All-Union Central Council of Trade Unions. The 18 persons in the Czech delegation represent the Central Trade Union Council and various trade union organizations of Czechoslovakia. We continue this news bulletin from Radio Moscow with items from abroad. Although the House of Representatives has not yet set the date for beginning the discussion on Truman's bill for giving aid to Greece and Turkey, members of the House have made statements about the bill. Phillips of California, speaking in the House against the bill, called Truman's policy false and anti-American. Another member of the House of Representatives, Bender of Ohio, declared that he was opposed to giving military help to Turkey, inasmuch as the Turkish government is not democratic. Reuters reports from Washington that Assistant Secretary of State Benton has informed a congressional subcommittee of the mysterious disappearance from State Department archives of agreements of historical significance. To campaign against anti-labor laws, the AF of L Executive Committee has decided to assign the sum of $1.5 million. The committee has declared that supporters of the anti-labor legislature are paving the way for fascism in America and has urged President Truman to veto the anti-labor bills that are designed to destroy trade union rights. An Associated Press report from New York quotes the CIO's head, Murray, as saying that he was negotiating for an immediate meeting with the head of the AFL Green to talk over the question of uniting the AFL and the CIO. The Rome newspaper, Unita, commenting on the results of the elections to the Consultative Assembly in Sicily, stresses that the anti-democratic, anti-republican, anti-popular forces suffered defeat in places where they regarded themselves as being the strongest. The People's Bloc, continues the paper, was victorious in spite of all obstacles, deception, slander, force, and corruption. The Italian socialist leader Nenni writes in the Avanti that the victory of the People's Bloc in Sicily is the prelude to the complete victory of the popular forces throughout the country in the coming general elections. Great interest has been aroused among the French public by Henry Wallace's visit in Paris. The newspapers France Tireur and Monde carried interviews with the ex-vice president of the United States. Mr. Wallace told a representative of the France Tireur that unity of Democrats throughout the world was essential in the interests of maintaining peace. He was returning to the United States on Friday, Mr. Wallace said, to launch a big campaign all over the country. According to the magazine New Republic, more than 70 prominent Americans have addressed a message to the leaders of the French political parties, giving their thanks for the invitation to Mr. Wallace to visit France and for support of his declarations in defense of peace. The message states that Mr. Wallace's firm conviction that only through the United Nations organization can the countries of the world guarantee a lasting peace reflects the feelings of the majority of the American people. Among those who signed the letter were Senator Taylor, the noted American explorer Stephenson, and others. It is reported from Munich that the Bavarian Minister of Food Supplies, Mr. Baumgartner, has declared his ministry is unable to cope with the threatening food crisis, especially as regards bread. The Greek Minister of Public Order reports a clash between armed police and partisans near the town of Sparta in South Greece. The clash lasted 7 hours, and both sides suffered heavy losses. You are tuned to Radio Moscow. Next comes a survey of today's Soviet press. Prominent in the newspapers today are the figures of the Russian Federation Statistical Board on the Federation's plan fulfillment in the first quarter of this year. The figures reveal substantial output increases over the same period last year, 12% for the Federation's government industries and 20% for the industrial cooperatives. Another front-page item is a letter to Generalissimo Stalin from the fishermen and fish cannery workers of Dagestan, a Caucasian autonomous republic on the Caspian Sea coast. In honor of the 30th anniversary of the revolution this November 7th, the Dagestan fishermen promised to fulfill their plan for fish catch ahead of time. They are the latest to join in the great production drive in honor of the anniversary, which has swept the whole country. News and comment on this drive gets a generous share of the paper's column space. Today, the Pravda, Izvestia, and Trud newspapers comment in their leading articles on the production competition in the mine. Another industrial subject, the development of the iron and steel industry in 1947, is dealt with in the Pravda by Tivasyan, the Minister of Iron and Steel. The output of iron is to increase by 22% as compared with last year, that of steel by 14%, and production of rolled goods by 20%. More ore, too, is planned, of course, and 28% more iron ore is to be mined. These figures, Tivasyan writes, go to show that in spite of the tremendous destruction and loss wrought by the German invasion, the capacities of Soviet metallurgy are growing at an ever-increasing rate. Trud, the trade union newspaper, prints the report delivered at the recent plenary meeting of the Central Trade Union Council by Sidorenko, Secretary of the Council. This report deals with the conclusion of collective agreements for 1947. In Red Star, the forces newspaper, Major General Zubkov writes on the downfall of the German military doctrine. The defeat of Hitler Germany in the war against the Soviet Union, he says, debunked the myth of the German army's invincibility and the perfection and infallibility of its military doctrine. The Germans claim to be the supreme authorities in military matters, but the Soviet army, smashing fascist Germany's war machine, shattered these claims to the winds. It broke down the complex sphere of the German army, which had dominated other armies for many decades past. The German military doctrine, General Zubkov concludes, was vanquished by the Stalin School of Military Science, the foremost school of military science in the world today. Among the comments on international topics, Melnikov discusses in today's Izvestia the subject of land reform and the food situation in Germany. He takes issue with the United States and British spokesman in the Council of Foreign Ministers, who have been quoting the bad food situation in the Western occupation zones as one of the main arguments against consistent fulfillment of the Crimea and Berlin reparations policy. With an impressive array of facts, the Izvestia writer shows that in reality, the deplorable condition of agriculture in the Western zones is not due to the collection of reparations from Germany. The facts prove that the big landowners who still retain their hold in the Western zones are openly sabotaging the food supply for the German population. There can be no doubt, Melnikov concludes, that a land reform in Western Germany similar to that in the Soviet zone would be productive of results. In Doolin, writing in the Red Star, draws the line between the real and alleged champions of the independence of Austria. Soviet representatives, he points out, have stated quite definitely that in taking possession of the German assets, the Soviet Union lays no claim to Austrian property. Yet this perfectly clear stand is distorted in every conceivable way and is represented to the Austrian public as an attempt to deprive Austria of independence. But, in Doolin goes on, the discussions on the Austrian treaty in the Council of Foreign Ministers have made it very plain who really want to see Austria independent and merely talk about Austrian independence as a disguise for their own narrow self-seeking interests. The British delegation, it will be remembered, proposes that Austria should not only restore all property owned by United Nations citizens before the Anschluss, but should pay compensation for any such property destroyed in the hostilities. The Red Star writer also points out that Austria's pre-war loans, for all practical purposes, deprived her of independence. One would think, he remarks, that in re-establishing a free and independent Austria, one of the first things to do would be to cancel loan terms which did not leave Austria even a vestige of independence in major financial matters. However, neither the British nor the American delegations agreed initially to the Soviet proposal that these terms should be repealed. That was what Soviet newspapers wrote about this morning. This is Radio Moscow. And now here is a commentary by Analyzer. He speaks today about President Truman's speech to American newspapermen.
There is certainly no dearth of speeches nowadays by prominent Americans. There is Truman's latest speech addressed to American newspapermen. There are the public speeches of many senators made in connection with the Greece-Turkey loan bill. There are the interviews, speeches, and statements made by Henry Wallace in France and elsewhere. Newspaper readers, not only in the United States, but in many European countries too, have been following these speeches with attention, seeking in them additional light on the policies now being unfolded by Washington. The speech made by the President last Monday dealt largely with domestic issues. Yet, Mr. Truman could not avoid, of course, commenting on matters of international concern, particularly since the bill on the loans to Turkey and Greece he has promulgated is now under consideration before Congress. The President wanted, of course, to make his audience see in that bill example number one of America's so-called eighth democracy. I do not know how many of the newspaper men the President was talking to agreed with him. But many things said in recent days the world over show conclusively that the ordinary people, whether Americans or Europeans, certainly have different ideas on this matter than Truman would like them to have. Senator William Langer of North Dakota, stating his reasons for voting against the Truman bill, said plainly enough, did not want American money to be used for strengthening the tyrannical government now existing in Greece. Tyrannical, mind you, and not democratic. The Athens correspondent of the New York Herald Tribune has just applied plentiful evidence to show how profoundly tyrannical the royal government in Athens really is. Correspondent regards the policy of the ruling circles of Greece as nothing government succeeded only in increasing the poverty and suffering in that unhappy country. The New York Herald Tribune man makes it plain also that the present Greek rulers are opposed to all progressive people, whether communist or not, and are intent on driving into the mountains all the people of Greece who are not afraid of expressing their opinions. So there you have Greek democracy, so-called, in action. Now, that very same New York Herald Tribune correspondent also said that it was precisely the support of Washington, the prospect of getting American dollars, that made the Greeks in the saddle in Athens go on so vehemently with their arch reactionary activity. The hope of getting a loan from Washington makes the rulers of Greece redouble their efforts aimed at throttling the least expression of progressivism, at killing off the bulk of the liberty-loving Greek people. Mark Twain, that great genius of American literature, in his Huckleberry Finn, The Prince and the Pauper, a Connecticut Yankee at King Arthur's Court, as well as in his satirical essays, expressed his dream of an America that would be a true friend of democracy and a consistent foe of feudalism and reaction. Today, honest American Democrats see, all the pious statements to the contrary notwithstanding, that Washington is trying to keep up, by means of dollar props, some of the most tyrannical totalitarian regimes on the earth's surface. Nor is it all. The debates on the Senate floor, as well as other public information, make it clear that this support of anti-democratic government by the United States is an expression of the dangerous anti-peace tendencies of exceedingly influential American circles. Senator Edwin C. Johnson of Colorado said the other day during the debate on the Greece-Turkey bill that a bogey of communism was being set up in America in order to camouflage military maneuvering on a tremendous scale. Senator Glenn H. Taylor of Idaho declared that American foreign policy was becoming the policy of military strategy. The meaning of all this activity of militaristically minded persons is shown also by statements made by certain gentlemen who are anxious to help Truman's program along, and who sometimes blurt out the straight facts behind it. A London broadcast in a foreign language the other day quoted Senator Vandenberg as stating that what Washington was doing now was the last attempt to put its ideas into effect without a war. There you have it. Vandenberg speaks for those men in America who are ready to declare to all other nations, either accept our ideas or else. He speaks for America's out-and-out expansion, seeking world domination. Or take the speech just made by the new American ambassador to Great Britain. He said that the United States, don't you see, had taken upon itself the burden of leading the world against the communists. Now, this self-appointed leadership of the world reminds one, of course, of what was being said not so long ago by other self-appointed world leaders, who incidentally also tried to cloak their expansionist aims with a bogey of communism. Now the question arises, what sort of people are behind it all? Who is the power behind the throne, so to speak? The answer can be discovered in the same speech by President Truman I have already referred to. Mr. Truman speaks of the dark clouds hanging over America's economic future. And he mentions the sky-high rise of prices wholesale and retail. He mentions also the excessive record-breaking profits, primarily made, it is natural to suppose, by those concerns which control the economic life of the United States. These monopolies in the steel, oil, automobile, food, and other key industries, of course, do not dare in the least that ordinary men and women in America are made to suffer on account of the high prices. They care only about profit, ever bigger profit. Their greed has no bounds. And it is these very men that swell the ranks of advocates of expansionist foreign policy. It is they who favor giving money to bolster up anti-democratic militarist regimes in Europe. Truly democratic Americans do not want expansionism, imperialism, support of feudalistic totalitarian regimes. Senator Taylor explained during the recent debate that the members of the United States Congress were ignoring the voice of the overwhelming majority of the American people. This majority is opposed to Truman's program with regard to Greece and Turkey. Senator Albert W. Hawks of New Jersey also indicated that the common people of America were very far from being pleased about Truman's plan. He invited the senator to take a trip through the country and hear what the people are saying. Of course, the people say what they feel, and there can be no doubt that the people feel their interests to be not on the side of expansionism, support of reaction, warmongering. Their interests are with peace, democracy, and hence teamwork among the great freedom-loving powers.
You are tuned to Radio Moscow. You've just heard a commentary by Analyzer. He spoke today about President Truman's speech to American newspapermen. We're transmitting on 11.63, 11.89, 15.16, 15.41, and 15.44 megacycles.